In April of 2026, a quiet but really profound shift happened across the global power grid.
Yeah, it was.
And if you were watching the data stream closely, you would have seen something that forecasters and modelers thought was still, years away.
Right, way ahead of schedule.
Exactly. For the very first time in human history, the electricity generated by the wind and the sun globally outpaced the electricity generated by burning gas.
It's a structural threshold that we crossed almost without fanfare. Wind and solar hit 22% of global electricity generation.
And gas slipped down to 20%.
Right, which is exactly why we're here today. I'm an energy analyst, and I'm thrilled to be here for this deep dive.
And I'm your host, thrilled to have you here. Because when you step into the world of global climate news, you are usually hit with this deluge of future casting, right?
Oh, yeah. Theoretical models, worst-case scenarios, the works.
Right. And it leaves you, as a listener, trying to figure out if the patient is doomed or getting better.
Yeah, you want to stay rigorously informed, but you do not want to drown in the noise.
So today we are putting down the abstract models. We're doing a deep dive into a comprehensive compilation of reports, articles, and hard data titled Global Climate Solutions.
And our mission here is to analyze the tangible, highly specific infrastructure being built right now, like as of June 2026.
That is the defining objective for us. We want to look past the commitments and the pledges.
We need to examine the actual physics and economics of the transition. The goal is to connect diverse data points across energy, heavy industry, and localized adaptation.
To really reveal the pragmatic picture of global climate resilience. So
Yeah.
let's jump straight into that April 2026 milestone, because here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, the Ember Report.
Right. You mentioned wind and solar hitting 22%. Why is that specific fraction such a watershed moment for the global economy?
Well, for decades, the growth of renewable energy was treated as like an addition to the margins.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
So a country would build a new wind farm, but they were still heavily relying on gas or coal for their baseline power needs.
Because their overall energy demand was still growing.
Exactly. What the data from the Ember report indicates is that clean power is moving from the periphery into the absolute center of the global electricity mix. It is actively displacing fossil fuels.
Wow. And the Guardian reported on a tipping point that set the stage for this back in 2025. They noted that clean energy generation grew enough to completely cover the rise in global electricity demand. Can you explain the mechanics of that energy hunger?
Sure. To appreciate the significance, you have to look at how global development works. I mean, every year, more people get access to air
Our
conditioning,
data centers are built.
right? And more vehicles are plugged in. Historically, even if we built thousands of solar panels, the sheer volume of new electricity required meant we also had to burn more coal and gas just to keep up.
So we were running on a treadmill.
Essentially, yes. But crossing that 2025 threshold meant that the manufacturing and deployment of renewables finally accelerated past the rate of new demand.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so once you cover the new demand, every additional solar panel you install starts eating into the existing fossil fuel-based share.
We see that playing out dramatically on a regional level, too. I mean, Canary Media reported that the United States set consecutive clean energy records throughout the spring of 2026.
Yeah, across solar generation, wind generation, and battery deployment, happening back to back.
But having the capacity to generate clean power is only half the battle, right? You have to
Really?
physically move it from where the wind blows to where the factories operate.
Which brings us to the most severe bottleneck in the entire transition, the transmission grid.
Right. Reuters published this deeply revealing piece on the Netherlands facing this exact crisis. They essentially had to implement power moratoriums
Yeah, it's a huge issue there.
because they have the clean power ready to go, and they have electrified industries demanding that power, but the physical infrastructure is choked up. Renewable projects are just sitting idle, waiting in line for a physical connection to the grid. What is the friction point there?
Well, the friction point is the vast disparity in construction timelines. I mean, the speed at which we can manufacture and deploy a solar array has vastly outpaced the speed at which we can permit and build high voltage transmission lines.
How big of a difference are we talking?
So a developer can build a utility scale solar farm in perhaps 12 to 18 months. But getting the environmental permits, securing the right of way across private lands, and physically laying the steel and copper for a new transmission line across multiple jurisdictions.
That sounds like a nightmare.
It is. It can take a decade or longer.
So we have this surplus of clean energy effectively stuck in traffic, but we cannot wait 10 years to pour concrete and lay steel.
No, we can't.
And this is where it gets cool.
Yeah.
Canary Media highlighted a software firm called OATI that is rolling out grid-enhancing technologies nationwide.
Yeah, their software approach is fascinating.
They are using software to push more electricity through the existing wires. But how does code change the physical capacity of a copper wire?
It comes down to a concept called dynamic line rating, or DLR. Historically, grid operators had to be exceptionally conservative.
Why is that?
Well, when electrical current flows through a transmission line, it generates heat. If the line gets too hot, the metal expands and the wire sags.
And if it sags into a tree, it can cause a catastrophic fault or spark a wildfire.
Exactly. So they assume the worst case scenario.
Right.
They assign a static capacity to that line based on assumptions of a hot, windless summer day. They artificially cap the amount of power allowed through the wire to ensure it never overheats.
That static rating ignores reality.
Reality being that the weather is constantly changing, yeah.
Exactly.
So dynamic line rating uses a network of sensors on the physical towers combined with real-time satellite weather data and artificial intelligence predictive modeling. Yeah, so the software might detect that a strong crosswind is currently blowing across a specific segment of the transmission line. That wind acts as a natural cooling mechanism for the copper wire.
Because the wind cools the wire, the electrical resistance drops, and the risk of sagging is eliminated for that specific moment.
You have the exact mechanism. The AI calculates that thermal dynamic in real time and tells the grid operator that they can safely push perhaps 30 or 40% more electrical current through that exact same wire at that very moment.
Let me frame this with an analogy for you, the listener. I picture our current power grid as an aging highway system.
Okay, I like that.
We have major traffic jams, right? Which is the renewable energy waiting at the on-ramp. Now, instead of waiting 10 years to bulldoze land, seize property, and build physical new lanes of asphalt, this grid-enhancing software acts as a highly advanced real-time traffic control system.
Mm-hmm.
It calculates the exact braking distance of every car, monitors the exact friction of the asphalt based on current rain conditions, and safely squeezes double the amount of cars onto the existing lanes.
That's a really great way to visualize it.
But I am going to push back here. What happens when that cooling crosswind suddenly dies down? If we were pushing maximum capacity and the wind stops, doesn't the line instantly overheat?
Well, that is the critical engineering challenge, and it is why the AI forecasting component is so essential.
How so?
The system is not merely reacting to the wind at this exact second. It is predicting the microclimate conditions 10, 20, and 60 minutes ahead.
Oh, I see.
So if the predictive model sees a drop in wind speed approaching, it automatically signals the grid operators to ramp down the current before the thermal limit is ever breached.
Is this software a permanent substitute for physical infrastructure then?
No, it is fundamentally a bridge. I mean, we will absolutely need to build more physical transmission lines to connect remote offshore wind and desert solar to dense urban centers.
Right. The software can only do so much.
Exactly. However, grid flexibility software ensures we are not wasting the next decade waiting for permits. What's fascinating here is that the grid of the future relies just as much on digital intelligence as it does on physical copper wires.
Okay, so if software optimizes how the energy moves, storage dictates when it moves.
Yes.
You simply cannot maintain a reliable grid powered by intermittent sources without a place to park that energy when the clouds roll in.
Right, which brings us to the battery revolution. The storage deficit has always been the primary argument against renewable dominance.
The sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow.
Exactly. But the deployment data from 2026 shows that the deficit is rapidly shrinking.
Look at the Tumbleweed Battery Project in Kern County, California, detailed by Canary Media. This facility can discharge clean power for 8 continuous hours.
8 hours is huge.
We are talking about absorbing solar power all day long when the sun is punishingly bright and energy is cheap, and then feeding it back into the grid all evening and straight through the night.
That 8-hour duration is a profound technological leap. Early grid-scale lithium-ion batteries were primarily designed for, 2-hour bursts.
What were they used for then?
Their job was frequency regulation, smoothing out the microscopic stutters in grid voltage. An 8-hour discharge fundamentally changes the grid's architecture because it neutralizes the evening peak demand.
The duck curve, as it is often called.
Mm-hmm.
The moment the sun goes down, solar production drops to zero, but everyone comes home, turns on their air conditioning, and starts cooking dinner. Demand spikes exactly when supply drops.
And historically, utility companies manage that spike by firing up gas peaker plants.
Those are the specialized ones, right?
Yeah. These are specialized power plants that sit idle most of the day and are suddenly throttled up to full capacity for a few hours in the evening. They are expensive to run, and they produce a disproportionate amount of localized pollution.
So by replacing those gas plants with 8 hours of stored daytime solar energy, you are excising the most expensive, dirtiest power generation from the entire system.
That's exactly it.
But the sheer volume of batteries required to do this globally is staggering.
It is a vast amount of material.
But the sources we reviewed highlight a fascinating shift in where these batteries are sourced. The World Resources Institute detailed the circular economy of batteries, focusing on retired electric vehicle batteries.
This is such a smart solution.
We are looking at a system where a battery's life does not end when the car goes to the scrapyard. Explain the physical life cycle of an EV battery. Why does it die in a car but remain useful elsewhere?
Well, the automotive environment is arguably the most hostile application for a lithium-ion cell.
Really? How so?
Think about it. When you drive an EV, you are demanding rapid acceleration, which draws a substantial surge of current. You are subjecting the battery pack to freezing winters and scorching summers.
I think the fast chargers.
Yeah. You are frequently fast charging it, pushing energy into the cells at extreme voltages. Over several years, these stressors cause microscopic physical changes inside the battery.
Things like lithium plating or the breakdown of the internal chemistry.
Precisely. The solid electrolyte interface layer thickens, which increases the internal electrical resistance. Eventually, the battery loses perhaps 20 or 30% of its total original capacity.
Okay.
When an EV battery drops to 75% capacity, the range of the vehicle is significantly reduced, and the software may struggle to deliver the peak voltage required for rapid acceleration.
So the owner replaces the battery.
Right. But that pack still retains 75% of its chemical storage potential.
Which brings us to this highly memorable example from Reuters, the energy storage system at Rome's Fiumicino Airport.
Oh, this is a great case study.
They launched a large storage system that runs entirely on second life, retired electric vehicle batteries. They're using them to store solar power for the airport.
Yeah.
Now, I have to challenge this premise for you listeners.
Yeah.
Because if I am the director of a major international airport, managing air traffic control radar, security grids, and terminal operations, there is no room for error.
None at all.
Why would I ever allow my critical infrastructure to rely on degraded, used car batteries?
I know it sounds counterintuitive until you examine the physics of stationary storage. What? We established that an EV battery degrades because of the high-stress, rapid-discharge demands of driving.
Right.
But a stationary storage facility operates on a completely different paradigm.
It is a slow, steady release.
Exactly. When you string hundreds of these retired batteries together in a climate-controlled shipping container, they are not being asked to accelerate a 2-ton vehicle from 0 to 60.
Right. They aren't moving at all.
No. They are being asked to release a low, steady trickle of voltage over several hours. Furthermore, the linchpin of this entire operation is the battery management system, or BMS.
Okay, so how does the BMS handle the fact that every single used battery in that container has degraded at a slightly different rate depending on how its previous owner drove their car?
That is the brilliance of the software. The BMS monitors the voltage, temperature, and internal resistance of every individual cell in real time.
Oh, wow. Every single cell.
Every single one. If it detects that a specific cluster of cells from an old sedan is running slightly hotter or has a higher resistance, the BMS dynamically reroutes the electrical load away from that weak spot and distributes it across healthier cells.
So it balances the entire array seamlessly.
Yes. So what is considered degraded in the high-performance automotive world translates to highly functional and extremely reliable in the stationary grid storage world.
That completely rewrites the life cycle economics of an electric vehicle. I mean, if the battery has a lucrative second act stabilizing an international airport, the residual value of the car changes.
Absolutely. It drives down the upfront cost of the vehicle and simultaneously drives down the cost of grid storage, making round-the-clock clean power substantially more accessible.
So what does this all mean? We are generating clean power more efficiently than ever. We are routing it intelligently through existing wires using dynamic line rating, and we are storing it in vast arrays of new and repurposed batteries. Mm-hmm. The next logical step is to look at how we utilize this clean power to tackle the hardest sectors of the economy. We need to move off the high voltage grid and walk into our factories and our basements.
Yes, let us examine how we are forging a new world through electrification. This is where the transition shifts from the utility companies to the consumer and the industrialist.
Right.
The objective is to eliminate combustion entirely at the point of use.
Let us begin at the residential level. Canary Media has reported extensively on the transition toward all-electric buildings, driven primarily by heat pumps.
Heat pumps are revolutionizing home heating.
And we are seeing innovative community group buying programs where organizing a neighborhood to buy heat pumps in bulk brings the capital cost down substantially.
Yeah, the bulk purchasing is brilliant.
But I think there is a persistent misunderstanding about how heat pumps actually work. They are not like traditional space heaters, are they?
Not at all. A traditional gas furnace or electric baseboard heater operates on the principle of creation. You burn fossil gas or you run electricity through a highly resistive wire to create heat.
Right, which takes a lot of energy.
Yeah, it is a one-to-one energy transfer and often less due to efficiency losses. A heat pump operates on the principle of movement. It does not create heat.
It simply moves existing thermal energy from one place to another.
Exactly.
Even in the dead of winter. Okay. I mean, how do you extract heat from freezing air?
It relies on the thermodynamics of refrigerants. A heat pump contains a closed loop of liquid refrigerant that boils at an extremely low temperature.
Oh.
Even if it is 20 degrees outside, there is still ambient thermal energy in the air. The outdoor unit utilizes a fan to pull that cold air across coils filled with the liquid refrigerant.
And because the refrigerant's boiling point is so low,
the ambient heat in the winter air is enough to cause the liquid to absorb the heat and evaporate into a gas.
Then the compressor takes over?
Correct. The system compresses that gas. And when you compress a gas, its pressure and temperature rise significantly.
Right.
That highly pressurized, extremely hot gas is pumped into the indoor unit, where a fan blows air across those hot coils, heating your home.
And as the heat transfers to your living room, the refrigerant cools, condenses back into a liquid, and the cycle repeats.
You've got it. Because it is merely moving heat rather than generating it, a heat pump can deliver 3 to 4 units of heat energy for every 1 unit of electrical energy it consumes. It is profoundly efficient.
So by shifting from a gas furnace to a heat pump, a household immediately unplugs from fossil fuels and taps directly into that increasingly clean wind and solar powered grid we analyzed earlier.
Exactly.
But scaling that concept up presents a unique challenge. You cannot simply attach a household heat pump to a steel mill or a cement factory. Heavy industry requires intense, continuous thermal energy, often steam at hundreds of degrees.
Yeah, that's a whole different ballgame.
This is where I found the thermal battery pilot at the University of Minnesota Morris deeply fascinating. They are capturing excess wind power from the grid and storing it as high-grade heat.
Industrial processes and large campus heating systems represent a substantial portion of global energy consumption. Historically, the only way to generate that high-grade steam was to burn coal or fossil gas on site.
Right, because you need so much concentrated heat.
And using chemical batteries, like the lithium-ion ones at the airport, to store electricity and then run giant resistive industrial heaters during peak hours is economically unfeasible.
So they changed the storage medium.
Exactly. They utilize a thermal storage system. The concept is to purchase electricity from the grid at night when the wind is blowing fiercely, but overall societal demand is at its lowest.
Because everyone is asleep.
Right. During those hours, electricity prices plummet, sometimes even dipping into negative pricing.
Wait, negative pricing?
Yeah, they essentially get paid to take the power. They use that cheap electricity to power massive resistive heating elements, transferring the thermal energy into a dense storage medium, such as specialized refractory bricks, crushed rock, or molten salt.
I picture this as a giant, highly efficient thermos. The university captures the kinetic energy of the wind, converts it into thermal energy, and traps it in a specialized thermos.
That's a great visual.
Then, on a freezing Tuesday afternoon when the campus needs steam, they do not fire up a gas boiler. They simply extract the stored heat from the bricks. It cuts combustion completely out of the heating equation.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, industrial electrification is about far more than just environmental stewardship.
What else does it offer?
Canary Media's reporting on this transition highlighted the vulnerability of traditional manufacturing. When a factory relies on fossil gas to run its boilers, its operational budget is tethered to a highly volatile global commodities market. A geopolitical crisis, a pipeline disruption, or a sudden spike in demand halfway across the world can cause their fuel costs to quadruple overnight.
It is an uncontrollable operational variable.
Precisely. By shifting to electrification and thermal batteries powered by domestic wind and solar, industry fundamentally insulates itself against global fuel price shocks. It turns a volatile expense into a predictable, stable cost.
That makes industrial electrification a crucial strategy for national energy security and corporate financial stability.
Absolutely.
Speaking of heavy industry, we must analyze the hardest sector of all, steel. Steelmaking is notorious for its huge carbon footprint.
Oh, yeah. It is responsible for roughly 8% of global emissions.
Which is astounding. Reuters reported a breakthrough that feels like science fiction. The Swedish mining company LKAB received a permit for a fossil-free sponge iron plant.
This is a game changer.
To understand why this matters, we have to look at how steel is traditionally made. It isn't just about melting iron ore, is it?
No, the heat is only part of the equation. Iron ore found in the earth is chemically bonded with oxygen. It is iron oxide. To make pure steel, you have to strip the oxygen atoms away from the iron.
And for centuries, the method has been to throw the iron ore into a blast furnace along with coking coal.
Right. And the carbon in the coal reacts with the oxygen in the ore.
Exactly. The carbon bonds with the oxygen, creating pure iron and a byproduct of carbon dioxide, which is vented into the atmosphere.
It is a chemical reduction process that intrinsically requires carbon.
But what LKAB is pioneering is direct reduced iron, or sponge iron, utilizing hydrogen instead of coal. Walk us through the chemistry of the new process. How does hydrogen strip the oxygen?
Well, they utilize an electrolyzer powered by Sweden's abundant clean electricity hydropower and wind to split water molecules into pure oxygen and pure hydrogen gas.
Okay.
They take that green hydrogen and inject it into the reduction shaft with the iron ore. The hydrogen reacts with the oxygen and the iron oxide, but instead of producing carbon dioxide, the byproduct of hydrogen bonding with oxygen is simply H2O.
Water vapor.
Water vapor.
It alters the foundational chemistry of a 19th century industry, turning it into a 21st century closed loop. The byproduct of making steel becomes steam.
And when you consider that steel is the structural backbone of everything from the wind turbines we are building to electric vehicle frames to city skyscrapers, decarbonizing that specific material lowers the embedded carbon footprint of the entire global economy.
I am going to challenge the time frame here, though.
Okay, let's hear it.
Rebuilding the global steel industry, constructing vast green hydrogen facilities, retrofitting millions of homes with heat pumps, and rewiring the grid with software takes decades. We were talking about turning around the largest physical supply chains in human history.
It's true. It's a generational project.
While those structural changes are executing, the scientific consensus is clear. We need a fast-acting lever to cool the planet right now. The long-term plays are essential, but what is the immediate intervention?
The immediate intervention requires us to shift our focus away from carbon dioxide and toward a completely different molecule, methane.
Why is methane the ultimate short-term target in the climate fight? It seems to get less press than CO2.
It comes down to atmospheric chemistry and the concept of short-lived climate pollutants. Carbon dioxide is the primary driver of global warming, but it is a highly stable molecule.
Once emitted, it persists in the atmosphere for centuries.
Right. Even if we zeroed out all CO2 emissions tomorrow, the legacy carbon would continue to warm the planet for generations. Methane behaves entirely differently.
How so?
It is highly potent. It traps over 80 times more heat than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. But it is structurally unstable. It breaks down in the atmosphere in approximately a decade.
So if you halt methane emissions today, the warming effect for that specific gas vanishes from the atmosphere relatively quickly.
Yes.
It is the difference between slamming on the brakes of a car versus slowly taking your foot off the gas pedal.
That is the exact atmospheric dynamic. If you want to shave a fraction of a degree off peak global temperatures in the near term, which is critical to prevent crossing irreversible ecological tipping points, cutting methane is the most mathematically efficient way to do it.
The technology to track and mitigate methane has taken a staggering leap forward. The United Nations Environment Program, UNEP, recently announced the expansion of satellite methane alerts to coal mines and waste facilities.
The MARS system.
Right, the Methane Alert and Response System, or MARS. They are using orbital technology to turn an invisible, odorless gas into a highly visible, actionable data point. How does a satellite detect a gas it cannot see?
It relies on spectroscopy. Every gas in the atmosphere absorbs light at specific wavelengths. Methane has a unique spectral signature. It absorbs specific frequencies of infrared light radiating from the Earth's surface.
Okay, so how do the satellites capture that?
High-resolution satellites equipped with specialized spectrometers continuously scan the globe. When they pass over a region, they measure the light reflecting back into space. If the sensor detects a dip in those specific infrared frequencies, it knows a cloud of methane is absorbing the light below.
So it maps the absorption pattern.
Precisely. It spots the plume, analyzes the wind direction to trace it back to its source, pinpoints the exact coordinates of the leaking infrastructure, whether it is an unlit flare stack at an oil facility or a venting pipe at a coal mine, and flags it in the MARS database.
Let us examine the geopolitical and corporate implications of this. In the past, tracking methane leaks from a gas pipeline required workers driving along the route with handheld sensors.
Yeah, it was slow, heavily reliant on voluntary corporate reporting, and honestly, easy to obfuscate.
So if we literally have an eye in the sky for you, the listener, to look at that and pinpoint exactly which company's infrastructure is leaking, doesn't that completely dismantle the era of voluntary reporting? You simply cannot hide your emissions anymore.
It forces a total paradigm shift regarding transparency. It moves the burden of proof from estimated voluntary corporate spreadsheets to undeniable, verifiable public observation.
If a satellite captures a sustained methane plume over a specific facility, regulators, institutional investors, and the public can view the data.
Right. It empowers governments to demand immediate infrastructural repairs and levy fines based on empirical evidence. It makes the invisible visible, and you can only manage what you can accurately measure.
And it isn't just fossil fuel infrastructure leaking this gas.
Yeah.
The UN Chronicle published a report focusing on a surprising, highly localized source of methane, food waste.
It is a source that is often omitted from high-level energy discussions, but its impact is enormous.
Well, let's break down the underlying biology. When someone throws away a bruised apple or a half-eaten sandwich, it inevitably ends up in a municipal landfill. Under normal conditions in a forest, organic matter decomposes aerobically, meaning it breaks down in the presence of oxygen, aided by insects and fungi, and eventually turns into nutrient-rich compost. But a landfill is a fundamentally unnatural environment.
Yeah, totally. That organic matter is dumped into a pit, crushed by heavy machinery, and buried under tons of synthetic trash, plastics, and dirt. It is a completely oxygen-deprived environment.
And that changes the type of bacteria that process the waste.
Exactly. It triggers anaerobic decomposition. In the absence of oxygen, a specific class of microbes, called methanogens, take over the decomposition process.
And what do they produce?
As they break down the food waste, their biological byproduct is methane gas, which percolates up through the trash and vents into the atmosphere.
Wow.
And when you consider that approximately one-third of all food produced globally for human consumption is lost or wasted, the volume of organic matter feeding these anaerobic bacteria is staggering.
The solutions highlighted by the UNEP focus on highly practical municipal efforts to have food waste by 2030. They are treating supply chain logistics as a scalable climate solution.
It is an intervention based on systemic efficiency rather than complex engineering. Preventing the organic matter from entering the landfill stops the methanogenesis before it can begin.
So what does that look like in practice?
Well, it involves altering grocery store aesthetic standards, so ugly produce is sold rather than dumped. It also means improving cold chain logistics to prevent spoilage during transport and establishing municipal composting programs to divert unavoidable food scraps into aerobic environments.
Furthermore, food redistribution platforms can seamlessly route perfectly edible, unsold inventory from restaurants and supermarkets to local food banks.
It addresses global hunger, cuts a highly potent greenhouse gas, and reduces the tipping fees municipalities pay to manage heavy, waterlogged food waste.
It is a reminder that not all climate progress requires orbital satellites or hydrogen electrolyzers. Sometimes it is just about better logistics and ensuring we do not throw away perfectly good food.
It represents a maturation in how we approach the transition. We are mitigating emissions from every conceivable angle, but even with perfect systemic efficiency, a completely decarbonized grid, and zero new methane leaks, we face a historical reality.
We have been dumping excess carbon into the atmosphere since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
While we use smart grids and heat pumps to stop putting more emissions up there, we must partner with nature to pull the existing legacy carbon out. Which brings us to harnessing the original carbon capture technology. Nature-based solutions.
Ecosystem restoration is arguably the most complex of all the solutions we have analyzed because you are managing living, breathing, interdependent networks rather than predictable mechanical systems.
And this is where we have to confront a substantial amount of corporate greenwashing. We have all seen the marketing slogans, "Buy our product and we will plant a tree."
Right, it looks great on a billboard.
But The Guardian featured an in-depth piece with ecologist Thomas Crowther, emphasizing the stark difference between simplistic tree planting campaigns and genuine ecosystem restoration.
It's a vital distinction.
I want to challenge the corporate approach here. If a corporation decides to offset its carbon footprint by purchasing cheap land and planting a million fast-growing pine trees in an area that historically supported a diverse broadleaf ecosystem or a natural grassland, are they just creating a biological desert?
This raises an important question, and your critique strikes at the heart of the problem. Treating nature merely as a carbon accounting trick is ecologically dangerous.
Because it's a monoculture.
Exactly. A monoculture, a dense plantation of a single tree species, is not a forest. It lacks the genetic diversity required to support local insect, bird, and mammalian populations.
And what happens to the resilience of that specific landscape?
It plummets. Fast-growing non-native species can severely disrupt local water tables, sucking streams dry. Furthermore, because every tree is genetically identical, a single pest or disease can eradicate the entire plantation in a matter of weeks.
Oh, wow.
And as you hinted at, if you plant dense rows of highly resinous pine trees in the wrong biome, you have effectively planted acres of kindling.
So when a drought hits, that monoculture becomes highly susceptible to catastrophic wildfires,
which instantly releases all the sequestered carbon back into the atmosphere. Crowther's research and the broader consensus in the scientific community insists that restoration must be ecologically appropriate and native to the specific region.
So, if random tree planting is harmful, how do scientists identify the correct locations and species?
That is where the latest global mapping research is deployed. Scientists are utilizing historical ecological data and satellite imagery to pinpoint optimal restoration sites.
What are they looking for?
They are identifying degraded lands where restoring the historical, diverse mix of native flora will maximize multiple benefits simultaneously. It will draw down carbon, stabilize topsoil to prevent agricultural runoff, regulate local water cycles, and restore critical migration corridors for wildlife.
It is a targeted, surgical approach to ecological repair.
Yes.
It is also essential to broaden our mental model of what constitutes a carbon sink. The World Resources Institute published several reports expanding on the concept of blue carbon and ocean climate solutions.
Blue carbon is fascinating.
When we think of carbon sequestration, we default to visualizing the Amazon rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be visualizing marine protected areas, mangrove forests, and coastal wetlands.
The ocean is actually the world's largest active carbon sink, absorbing roughly a quarter of all human-generated carbon dioxide emissions. But coastal ecosystems, specifically mangroves, salt marshes, and seagrass meadows, are the powerhouses of biological sequestration.
How does a mangrove swamp outpace a terrestrial forest in carbon storage?
It relates to the soil chemistry. A terrestrial tree stores carbon in its trunk and leaves, but when it dies and falls to the forest floor, it decomposes aerobically, releasing much of that carbon back into the air.
Okay, but mangroves are in the water.
Right. Mangroves operate in an intertidal zone. They drop their leaves and organic matter into saline, waterlogged sediment. That sediment is anoxic. It lacks oxygen.
So the decomposition process essentially freezes.
Exactly. The lack of oxygen inhibits the bacteria that would normally break down the organic matter. Therefore, the carbon is trapped in the dense root systems and buried deep in the underwater sediment, where it can remain safely sequestered for millennia.
Acre for acre, coastal wetlands can sequester carbon at rates far exceeding mature tropical forests.
Mm-hmm.
But protecting these regions requires a very specific approach to governance. You cannot simply draw a line on a map, declare a coastline a protected zone, and deploy enforcement officers.
Absolutely not. True nature-based solutions require a foundation of territorial justice.
What does that mean in practice?
Well, top-down conservation models that attempt to evict local inhabitants or restrict traditional fishing rights historically fail. The local population is economically alienated and forced to exploit the resources illegally just to survive.
Which makes sense.
Right. Successful restoration requires empowering the indigenous and local communities who have generationally managed those specific regions. They possess the historical ecological knowledge of the area.
By making the local community the direct stewards and economic beneficiaries of the restored ecosystem through sustainable fisheries management or ecotourism, the conservation effort becomes self-sustaining.
Exactly.
Which flows perfectly into our final analysis today. Because empowering local communities is not just about pulling legacy carbon out of the air, it is about surviving the environmental changes that are already locking in. We must discuss ground-level defense, community adaptation, and resilience finance.
Yeah, adaptation is key.
Even if we execute every solution we have explored today flawlessly, the dynamic grids, the fossil-free steel, the satellite tracking the climate has already changed. The atmosphere already holds excess heat.
The paradigm is twofold. Mitigation is how we avoid the unmanageable scenarios. Adaptation is how we manage the unavoidable realities.
And for millions of people worldwide, the unavoidable impacts are already manifesting as extreme heat waves, prolonged droughts, and intense flash flooding.
This is where the narrative shifts from high-level infrastructure to deeply human, localized action.
I was captivated by a report in The Guardian detailing the grassroots climate adaptation projects in Comuna 8 in Medellin, Colombia.
Oh, that's a brilliant example.
This is a densely populated neighborhood situated on the steep, informal hillsides of the city. Historically, they have been exceptionally vulnerable to heavy rainfall triggering landslides and dense concrete causing severe urban heat islands. But the residents did not wait for a massive federal engineering intervention.
They initiated localized, highly calibrated defense mechanisms.
Right. They designed and installed rainwater harvesting systems across the neighborhood rooftops to capture and slow down the runoff during intense storms, preventing the soil saturation that leads to landslides.
Mm.
They built extensive community eco-gardens to break up the concrete, and they conducted their own community risk mapping, walking the terrain to identify and monitor specific geological stress points.
It is a masterclass in decentralized, locally led action. They utilize their intimate knowledge of their own topography to build physical resilience.
And we are seeing the exact same principles validated on a much larger scale globally.
Yes.
The Global Center on Adaptation and the World Bank have reported extensively on the Suncasa project in sub-Saharan Africa. This initiative demonstrates the physical mechanics of urban greening in rapidly expanding African cities. Explain the physics of urban greening. How does planting trees directly protect a city from extreme heat?
It is a process called evapotranspiration. When a city is paved with dark asphalt and concrete, it absorbs solar radiation all day and radiates it back out at night, creating a localized heat dome.
And trees disrupt this?
Yes, trees disrupt this. They provide physical shade, preventing the asphalt from absorbing the radiation in the first place. But more importantly, trees absorb water through their roots and release it as water vapor through their leaves.
Oh, so the phase change.
Exactly. This phase change, liquid water turning into vapor, absorbs thermal energy from the surrounding air. It acts as a natural, localized air conditioning system, significantly lowering the ambient temperature of the entire neighborhood.
And restoring urban wetlands provides a similar defense against flooding.
It makes me think of these community eco-gardens and restored green corridors as a city's biological immune system.
That's a profound way to look at it.
If a city relies entirely on a giant concrete seawall, it has a rigid binary barrier, tries to block the physical shock of a storm surge. But if that wall breaches, the city is completely devastated.
Right, there's no backup. A restored wetland network operates entirely differently. It is not a rigid wall. It is a living, adaptable sponge. It absorbs the shock, soaks up the floodwaters, lowers the ambient temperature through evapotranspiration, and helps the city recover faster.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize the infrastructure of the future, but there is a persistent systemic hurdle to building this immune system, and that is the financial reality.
Because adaptation funding is currently scarce compared to the capital flowing into renewable energy generation.
Exactly.
I'm looking at the scale of projects like Suncasa, and my immediate thought is, who cuts the check? A solar farm generates a measurable product electricity that you can sell to a grid operator for a predictable return on investment.
Mm-hmm.
But a restored urban wetland doesn't send out a monthly invoice for flood protection. How are they convincing private investors or development banks to fund these ground-level defenses?
We are witnessing a fundamental paradigm shift in how global finance calculates the value of nature. World Bank reports on financing nature-based infrastructure detail how insurance companies, institutional investors, and municipal governments are adopting a metric called the avoided cost of disaster.
They are monetizing the disaster that didn't happen.
Precisely. They run the actuarial models and look at the projected cost to rebuild a specific city after a severe flood. The data makes a compelling economic case.
Which is?
Well, funding the restoration of a mangrove swamp or implementing a sponge city design with permeable pavements today might cost $10 million. Rebuilding the flooded commercial district, replacing the destroyed public transit systems, and managing the economic fallout of business closures tomorrow will cost $2 billion.
It is an investment in risk reduction and asset protection.
By treating wetlands, mangroves, and urban forests not as decorative landscaping, but as critical, investable public infrastructure, just like a bridge or a power plant, they can unlock the necessary capital pools.
Innovative financial instruments, like catastrophe bonds and resilience impact bonds, are scaling these community defenses globally by proving that preventing the damage is infinitely cheaper than repairing it.
Yes, the economics finally support the ecology.
We have covered an astounding amount of ground today. Let us trace the journey for you, the listener. We started by examining the macro-level physics of the grid, looking at how the global surge in wind and solar is actively displacing fossil fuels.
We explored how dynamic line reading software and intelligent battery management systems are making our existing infrastructure hyper-efficient.
We moved into the factories, detailing how thermal bricks and hydrogen electrolyzers are fundamentally altering the chemistry and economics of heavy industry.
We looked at the skies, where spectroscopy is forcing unprecedented corporate transparency regarding methane leaks, and down to our municipal logistics to see how optimizing food waste is a rapid cooling lever.
Finally, we explored the biological defense mechanisms of nature-based solutions and the financial restructuring required to fund community-led adaptation.
The overarching narrative synthesizing these diverse sources is unmistakable. The era of pure theoretical modeling and future pledges is behind us.
The tools for systemic mitigation and localized adaptation exist. The physics are sound, the economics are proven, and the era of physical implementation is actively underway.
It really is.
And analyzing the sheer volume and diversity of these solutions currently scaling up globally should give you a profound sense of informed optimism. The challenges remain vast, without question, but the physical machinery of the solution is being built all around us.
It's an exciting time to be following this space.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
All the sources we examine today focus on how we are adapting our physical world, our transmission lines, our steel, our coastal wetlands to survive and stabilize the climate. But consider the societal architecture. As we transition from a highly centralized fossil fuel system, where a few centralized corporations and state monopolies control the oil extraction and the massive power plants, to a world of radical physical decentralization, we are moving toward a reality of solar panels on your roof, neighborhood thermal batteries, virtual power plants, and localized eco-gardens controlled by the community.
That's a huge shift.
How will this physical decentralization alter our social and political structures? If a neighborhood controls its own power generation, stores its own energy, and engineers its own flood resilience, does the global energy transition ultimately force a radical redistribution of societal power?
Wow, that's a big question.
It is a complex question, but one where the answers are slowly coming into focus as the infrastructure changes. Something to think about until our next deep dive.